It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation is investigating the fatal shooting of a Madison man by Madison police on Wednesday.
Public officials have identified the victim as Corey Ruiz, and video from witnesses show an officer firing multiple shots at him while police were attempting to arrest him.
The police department says Ruiz had pulled out a knife and injured the officer who fired the shots.
In a press conference yesterday, Madison Police Chief John Patterson said his department will cooperate fully and not hide from any aspect of the investigation.
This is an open and active homicide investigation right now. In accordance with state statute, long-standing practice, the Madison Police Department has called for a thorough and independent criminal investigation into yesterday's shooting.
Madison police do not have body-worn cameras, but Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway indicated that funding to purchase them will be included in her city budget proposal for the first time later this year.
We're checking in on how police shootings are investigated by outside agencies and what role body cameras and video footage can play in incidents like these.
Michael Bell Sr. is a victims' rights activist and former Air Force pilot from Kenosha. His son was killed by police in 2004, and he later helped pass the state law that mandates independent investigation into police shootings. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How does this work? What does this investigation look like when an outside agency comes to investigate a police shooting?
Well, first off is that, as you heard the police chief say, in accordance with state statute, up until 2014, that state statute didn't even exist. For 100 years prior to that, all police departments investigated their own shooting, and historically, none of them had ever found themselves unjustified. And in the shooting death of my son in 2004, they did that, and there was tremendous amount of conflicting interest, and we never still had a proper investigation. But I and a group of advocates in the Madison area, along with Gary Bies, who was a state House Assemblyman, and Chris Taylor, helped pass the first law in the nation that mandated that all police shootings be investigated by an outside agency. So this is a good, this is a really good thing, because when co-workers investigate themselves, they tend to overlook the true facts. And I'm very happy that the Department of Justice is coming in, because of the fact that the Department of Justice doesn't have any skin in the game. If Milwaukee had a shooting and the Sheriff's Department decided to investigate a police shooting in Milwaukee, you know, there's skin in the game because there's retribution. But the Department of Justice itself doesn't have any skin in the game, and therefore they need to conduct the investigation.
When this shooting has happened now, does this investigation look like any other kind of shooting investigation? I've seen some concerns that there's some lag time between the incident itself and when the outside agency might start getting, for example, statements from witnesses or the officers themselves.
Well, they should take over immediately, and I've always watched that. But you know, you have to call the agency in, so they have to protect the crime scene. That became a problem in Milwaukee because there was a shooting there, and before they can get an outside investigation team in there, the body laid under the ground under a cover, and the residents in the local neighborhood saw that, and it sat there for like 8 hours before they can get a team out there. So this is something that has to happen immediately, but there isn't a response team available.
I get the sense in some of these police shootings, there is skepticism. Even with an outside agency, people might worry there's still law enforcement and be looking to cover the backs of their colleagues, even if it's in another agency. Do you personally feel more trust in this system that because it has an outside agency, despite those concerns?
I'm going to tell your listeners right now that after I've been looking at police-involved shootings for over 20 years, I do have a lot of confidence in this system, because they have a reputation to maintain, and they don't want to just protect themselves. So, yes, I do have confidence in the system.
And I've talked to you in the past. Part of the role here is finding out what happened, finding out if charges should be filed. An important thing to you as somebody who had been with the Air Force is saying, what do we learn from this to prevent a future incident? You modeled your proposals in part on post-air incident accidents. What do you hope in tragedies like this we can learn to prevent future tragedies?
Well, if the system was in place like the NTSB, we would look at every aspect of this and say, what can we do to prevent this from happening again? That doesn't happen in law enforcement. I can tell your listeners right now that if there was a knife, that officer is justified in using deadly force. But does it mean it's necessary? And I think the situational awareness of that officer might have been a little bit diminished. He didn't recognize that that there were four officers standing over somebody that was on the ground. He was being tased, and that officer used deadly force. And that's a training scenario, and that could be improved upon. But I'm telling your listeners right now that my looking at this for over 20 years, this shooting is going to be real justified.
You think it will be ruled justified based on what you've seen so far?
Yes.
Do you think that is, again, based on your background and what you've seen so far, do you think that would be the appropriate outcome?
You have to give an officer the right to make a decision in a life and death moment. You can't take that away from him. Whether that means it's necessary or not is something that's important. But you have to give the. You have to remember, an officer is. He has to make a split decision and come back and second guess it the next day. But doing a proper investigation is the first part. But then having a group look at it and say, what went wrong, and how do we prevent this from happening again? And I assure you that things can be done differently to make sure that the training is more improved. Right now, and anytime an officer sees knife, he automatically knows in his brain that he can use deadly force. I want your listeners to take a look at an 87-year-old woman who was tased on July 3rd of 2019 for pulling dandelions, because she had a knife. They were screaming at her, drop the knife. She was Polish. She didn't understand what was going on. She was wearing a babushka, and they tased her. That is the exact same mentality that is occurring in law enforcement across this nation, and especially in Wisconsin. And there are other incidents very similar to this where deadly force was used just down the road from Madison in Neillsville.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Kate. Bye.
That's Michael Bell, senior victims' rights activist, former Air Force pilot from Kenosha. He lost his son in a police shooting in 2004. With us today to share how independent law enforcement agencies investigate police shootings under a Wisconsin law he helped pass in 2014. Now we're looking at the role that video footage can play in investigations and public perception of police shootings. Madison is one of the state's few large city police departments that's not using body-worn cameras. Megan Perry is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Rhode Island. She focuses her research on public perceptions of police misconduct and use of force and the use of video. Megan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Madison Common Council President Sabrina Madison described what it was like watching bystander video of Wednesday's police shooting during a press conference yesterday. Here's a listen.
I don't see what's happening altogether. There's some cars in a way. But I can hear the sounds. I can hear the sounds. I can hear the words, taser. And I could just hear the shots. And it's the shots that don't escape you.
Megan, what kind of difference does it make when the public has immediate access to video of a police shooting, as happened in Madison, as opposed to delayed release of the footage or no recordings at all?
Well, any amount of viewing of police interactions, especially those that use force, are going to impact public perceptions, right? Even when, like Michael was saying, it's a justified legal issue, we still are going to walk away from that video feeling worse about the police most of the time. So far as viewing bystander video or those from citizen journalists, maybe first or the only one that we're allowed, we don't have any other information. So we're only going to piece what was presented. And for the most part, bystanders, we tend not to start filming until the middle of an incident, until we see that, hey, there's something going on. So there's going to be a lot of context that's missing. And like she was saying, there's a lot of disruption or things in the way that from those angles that you might not be able to really see and understand what's happening and why that officer might be making that choice.
Do you think that the presence of often bystander videos and in some cases police body cams changes the behavior of police officers and bystanders for that matter?
Yes and no. It depends on what kind of behavior you're talking about. So far as, you know, there's a lot of talk around body-worn cameras is going to reduce officer use of force. The research just doesn't hold that up, right? It doesn't really statistically change how often or when force is used, right? But we have seen that there is some changes around officer complaints. And so that's interesting in terms of that might be changing how the officer might be interacting with somebody, or it might change how the civilian might be interacting with the officer when they know they're filmed, right? So it can change. It's called the civilizing effect a bit. Those interactions are transactional. So somebody comes into it really hot, you oftentimes respond, and that can be how something can escalate. So when the presence of a camera can kind of cool things down a little bit.
Very briefly, Megan, I think the hope is always that police body cams or bystander cams, they're going to give us the real story. They'll tell us clearly what happened. People come away from watching videos with different conclusions a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the hardest things, I think, for policing is that, you know, you and I and, you know, everybody else, Michael and whoever else can all watch the exact same video. And there's this kind of false idea that it's completely objective. It's going to show the objective truth, but we're bringing our subjective opinions to what we're seeing. Are we?
Thanks to Megan Perry, professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Rhode Island. We also heard from victims' rights activist Michael Bell, Sr. of Kenosha.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a roller coaster Democratic primary for governor that has seen candidates drop out and re-enter. Our reporters at the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast talk about the campaign dynamics with the primary less than 3 weeks away. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez dropped out of the Democratic primary race for governor last week. But another candidate, Milwaukee County Executive David Crawley, jumped back in. Crawley quickly received Governor Tony Evers' endorsement.
But we don't know yet what voters think of Crawley. In the latest episode of Inside Wisconsin Politics, our political reporters look at the campaign's dynamics just a few weeks before the August 11th primary.
Joining the discussion are WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
This race is pure chaos now, wouldn't you say? I mean, when you think about it, just last week we were talking about Sarah Rodriguez's campaign sort of teetering. Shortly after, it fell. And then almost immediately, you had David Crawley, who had been out of the race, get back in. Anya, why did David Crawley take that step so quickly after Sarah Rodriguez dropped out? Why did it need to be him in this race?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great question, and I think we're kind of trying to hammer down exactly what that 8-day calculus kind of was. So he dropped out. He backed Sarah Rodriguez. A couple days later, she made this announcement that there were issues with her campaign, but she was going to stay in. And I spoke to him a little bit ago, and his timeline of events is essentially that she informed him what was going on. He, you know, reiterated his support for her campaign. started hearing from backers all week that they wanted him back in, that essentially there was different information than what he had dropped out on. And we started hearing from sources that maybe he was going to get back in with the finance deadline. Never heard back from him when I directly asked this last week. And then we started to hear the rumblings on Friday as Sarah announced that she was dropping out, that he was going to announce the next day. And then we kind of got that confirmation. So it really was almost a trading of who was going to be potentially this front runner. The other thing that, of course, came with his announcement was Governor Tony Evers endorsing him. And so that he suddenly became the sort of person who is tied to that administration in this race.
Yeah, I don't feel like you can talk about the Crowley candidacy without talking about Governor Tony Evers and that decision. Zach, why did Tony Evers, who has told us repeatedly throughout this primary cycle, I'm not going to get involved, why did he get involved now? And why did he say David Crowley's my guy?
Well, he always, the second half of the statement of I'm not getting involved is that I might decide later. And that always felt like keeping the back door open, but unlikely to be used. Well, he went through the
he
back door.
He played that card.
He definitely did. He played his euchre card, his last right. Jack in the hole for that. The reason why it seems it only can be that he and others that think like him are not happy with Francesca Hong and the lead she has throughout this entire race. All the polling, including the stuff we're going to talk about later in this very show, shows that she is a clear front runner for the Democratic primary. And really, there's been no ability for anyone else to centralize all of the support for the centrist, moderate Tony Evers heir to take over that position. We had heard that Evers and Crowley got along, that they liked each other. How much of that personal relationship matters, we don't know. It matters a lot in politics. Sarah Rodriguez clearly had that position even without the endorsement, so Tony Evers could say, I'm not the kingmaker here. Clearly, him stepping in is that he felt he needed to use some of his political capital to try and boost someone to take on Francesca Hong and make it a two-person race.
Yeah, Rich, we've been kind of hinting at that that Hong dynamic all campaign cycle, but until now, Democrats hadn't been out there saying it. You covered the Crowley announcement this past Saturday. He's saying it now.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't name her when he announced, but it was pretty obvious who he was talking about. He referenced the Republican Governors Association, the RGA, putting up ads that it says are attacking her, but Democrats feel that it's actually boosting her and aimed at trying to get her to clear the Democrats' nomination. So he mentioned that, and it's pretty obvious what's going on here.
So what does this say about what Tony Evers thinks about the rest of the field, Anya?
Well, I think it was a bit of a dance that he needed to be doing because he does have relationships with everybody else in the field. So obviously it was his current lieutenant governor who stepped out, Sarah Rodriguez, but his former lieutenant governor, Mandela Barnes, is in there, his former DOA secretary, Joel Brennan, and then Kelder Royce, who's been in the legislature alongside him for quite a number of years. David Crowley, in some ways, is actually the person he has the least professional relationship with just because, you know, David operates at the county level. He's not in the state legislature quite as much, so they haven't necessarily, you know, worked. He hasn't served in the administration, I guess I should say. And so it's interesting that this is the person that he's choosing to back because he does have, you know, as you say, he pulled the one card that he kind of has, and he's putting it behind this person who dropped out, who had said that he didn't have the finances, who said he didn't have the path. And so Tony Evers is saying, both I back this person, I back his politics, and I think I can help him get that path.
I will say, if you just walk back a few years, David Crowley used to be a legislative staffer. The governor's chief of staff used to be a legislative staffer who has called David Crowley a friend, and she is influential in the governor's office. So there's possible that he was getting advice there, that David Crowley is a good candidate. So what's the theory of how this works out, though, Zach? I mean, the governor's office and Crowley are going into this thing thinking, we're going to take this big risk. They must think they could win. How does it work?
That's a good question. And we have seen how quickly the dynamics in this race can change on the ground. We have seen candidates rise and fall according to finance reports, according to polling, candidates dropping out, coming back in. Things are happening rapidly. And one thing, it feels like it's really close to this primary election because ballots have already been returned. The Democratic Party is worried about people not being able to spoil those ballots if they if they back someone who's dropped out. And there's still a long way to go, though. There's still a couple of weeks. There's more polls. There's a lot more ad spending. And as we're going to explain, there was actually an incident that happened in Madison last night with the police that involved shooting. These kind of things shake up races in a big way by putting candidates in difficult positions to see how they react. And they are judged according to that.
Yeah, we do want to acknowledge that shooting, people are reacting to that shooting that took place Wednesday. There's a vigil tonight or Thursday as we record this. This is going to be a thing. You've already seen the candidates react to some very strongly. It's going to affect the race. We're just going to take a pause here and wait for more information to learn more about this before we talk about it in this setting. Rich, turning to something very explicitly political, the Marquette poll came out this week. We've been looking forward to this for a while. The last time Marquette polled on the race for governor was in March. So why did this one that we've been kind of marking on our calendar seem so incomplete?
You're saying we marked the Marquette poll on our calendars?
I mean, we might have. Yes.
It's because it is incomplete. It's not a full picture. But it's through no fault of the pollsters, who I'll mention in a second. But the questions went out to Wisconsin voters between July 8th and the 16th. Well, July 8th is when the things kind of got crazy in the primary. Crowley had dropped out on July 8th when the questions were out, so he wasn't included in the results that we saw. And also, the poll asked about Rodriguez. Her information was included, but she ended her campaign essentially right after they got the data back from their surveys. So it's still good information, still gave us a sense of where things are at least among those that were included in the poll results. But it's just a partial picture. So I wanted to give a shout-out to pollster Charles Franklin, who I know watches this podcast. And we all really appreciate the work that Charles and the rest of his team do. And I think we can sympathize, at least I can, that we've all been in a position where we're writing a story or we just published a story only to have the news change and essentially make that story, you know, totally outdated and you have to start from scratch. So it's like throwing darts at a moving target. It's pretty tough. So kudos to them for doing what they could.
Rich Kramer looking to boost his approval rating with Marquette's pollster there with a shout-out. So let's take a look at those results real quick. The candidates who remain in the race, this is when you don't include David Crowley and you don't include the voters who picked Sarah Rodriguez. Francesca Hong leads the pack with 27%, followed by Mandela Barnes with 18, Joel Brennan with 5, Kelderoy's with 2, and 48% undecided. So Francesca Hong leads the field. This is the third Marquette poll that she's done that in this year. Does she have this locked up?
I mean, I think if she had it locked up, we wouldn't be seeing the deck shuffling that we keep seeing, because she does very well in these polls. She has a very energetic base of support, and yet she doesn't have the power players kind of unifying behind her because they keep trying to find an alternative. I think if she, you know, had it locked up, so to speak, there would be a confidence from the sort of Democratic authorities, the Democratic kingmakers, that would say that she can win both the primary and win the general. And I think we are seeing maybe implicitly more than explicitly a real concern that she can't. And so who can they kind of bring in order to beat Tom Tiffany? And so she does very well in a Democratic poll, although, again, I think we also have to talk about that 48% undecided number. But can she do well in a general? That's sort of the big question that Democrats are very worried about.
Yeah, let's talk about that. 48%, nearly half of the people, half of the Democratic voters who respond to this saying, I don't know who I'm going to vote for. Zach, what's the deal? We've been doing podcasts about this rate all summer. Why are so many people not sure about this, what we thought was going to be a very high-profile race for governor?
Because those 48% make up a lot of people who don't watch this podcast, so they are not as informed. There are a lot of people who don't pay attention to politics until the very end. I just got the first campaign flyer in my mailbox this morning. they're starting to come. Those people will follow along. Another thing that happens in primaries pretty regularly is people wait to see if there is a front runner. They don't like to waste their vote on someone who will not win, or they're going to say, well, I like this person, but they're in fourth place and they're not polling very high. Why would I throw it behind them? Who's my next favorite? Which is another good thing the Marquette poll does. They do. Who is your next favorite in line? Another thing to look at is Tom Tiffany's unopposed and Republican primary. There's still 30% undecided there.
Now, that's quite a finding.
They're going to vote for the Republican, but I think you can take that 30%, put it over and compare it to the 48% for the Democrats and go, okay, there's just a lot of people that either aren't tuned in yet or they're waiting to the last minute to figure out who is actually the front runner, who do I trust to be the candidate for my favorite party.
A large portion of Wisconsinites have just been living their lives this year, it turns out, and we'll turn out.
Kudos to them.
Kudos to them. So what about the candidates who are toward the bottom of this polling? Joel Brennan and Kelder Royce. Brennan at 5%, Royce at 2%. Where does that leave them? Rich, I'll go to you first. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it leaves them in the position that they've been in for a while. They're just towards the bottom of the heap in terms of the polling we've seen. So ultimately, they and their supporters and their donors have decisions to make, whether they stay in the race or whether they drop out and endorse someone like a Crowley or a Hong or a Barnes or whoever. I've never been in that position. I don't know what all you have to think about. They've clearly invested a lot of time and resources into their races thus far, so maybe they won't drop out. But at some point, you would think that those are conversations happening within the campaigns.
Seems like they are saying, we have money, and if, you know, sharing their own internal polling, if voters get to know us, they like us. And so a lot of race left to run from their point of view. Joel Brennan is actually running probably the most negative ads I've seen in the primary, where he lists all the sort of front runner candidates and explains kind of explicitly why they can't win in November, his words. Anya, I mean, what's going on with Joel Brennan's decision there?
You're right. I think it is a kind of tonal shift. We've talked about some of these, you know, attacks on social media, but this is a really kind of negative ad. It has the, you know, the color tint over the, like, the opponents that you normally kind of see more in a general. And I think it goes to this kind of game that voters tend to play in competitive primaries in such a swing state like Wisconsin, where, again, you are not taking for granted that the winner of a primary is going to win the general, as might happen in other states, where Democratic voters right now are like playing 3D chess. They are not just trying to identify who is the candidate that I support, but who is the candidate that my neighbors are going to support. And so therefore, how can I make sure to kind of get the most out of my vote? And so he's speaking to that electability question and essentially saying, I am the most electable. And then when you do have 48% undecided, there's maybe an argument to be made, or he's trying to make the argument of like, well, what would happen if all 48% of them went to me, right? That's a lot of extra voters. So yes, he's now 3% to Fran Hong's, you know, 27% to Mandela Barnes's 18%. But if he gets half of those undecideds, he's a front runner. And so maybe he's kind of banking on that.
There you go. Marquette did look at, they looked at a lot, but they had some head-to-head matchups in there. If you look at those, you get a slightly different story. Of the Democrats in the race right now, not including David Crowley, only Mandela Barnes defeats Tom Tiffany in a head-to-head matchup by a 44-40% split among registered voters. Tiffany leads Francesca Hong 43-40%. So a plus 4 for Mandela Barnes, minus 3 for Francesca Hong. Zach, I mean, I think it kind of begs the question, why did the establishment not rally around Mandela Barnes?
Well, I think that's the question Mandela Barnes' campaign is asking and saying you might have made a mistake if you are looking for a Hong alternative. That's certainly what they are pushing right now. But I think one of the distinctions is Barnes came in with the most name recognition of everyone due to his 2022 U.S. Senate run, his close loss to Ron Johnson. And it was always a question because he also had the highest negatives that came with that hangover from that election. And he started running this race as the front runner. He introduced himself as saying, I'm the one to take on Tom Tiffany. He did the thing where he ignores the rest of the field and kind of pretends they weren't there. And then partway through this election, I think he or his campaign realized, oh, no, Francesca Hong is there. I do have to take her seriously. So he kind of had to shift his tone to talking about his competitors, where I think at first he was running the 2022 U.S. Senate primary, where all of his competitors dropped out at the end, and he basically had the field to himself. That didn't happen. So it is a question of, did the rest of the field say, you've had your chance and you couldn't make your case, now we're going to go with someone else? Or is it simply that they think Harrod's negatives are too high despite the head-to-head matchup looking good? So it is a legitimate question for Evers. It's a legitimate question for voters out there of how should they take all these different pieces of information? And that's what happens when you have this many centrist or moderate candidates all trying to claim that one mantle, is they can divide the field, which is what they're doing.
And now Mandela Barnes is attacking the establishment, which was definitely his friend 4 years ago. We should talk real quick before we wrap up here today about what happens with all these tens of thousands of voters who cast absentee ballots and maybe want to change those ballots. A short answer, can they?
No.
Well, what?
Not at this moment.
Yeah. According to Wisconsin Election Commission guidance, the answer is no. That guidance was issued voted on July 9th, issued on July 10th. Anya, you had a
Well, yes. Yeah, so, you know, truly moments before we started taping, I got sent motions that were filed in court. So there is now a lawsuit about this. I did not have a chance to open those documents. And so we won't talk about them today.
I skimmed them. Yeah.
But I They're suspect that we'll talk
the
about
commission
them
is
soon.
Wrong.
Yeah, that's yeah. right. And so and that's something that's going to need to get resolved pretty quickly. And the primary is August 11th.
And so for people who you are talking tens of thousands of people who voted, 80,000 people have now voted absentee. So that's definitely something that we'll have to watch get resolved through the courts potentially. But as of right now, those votes cannot be counted in this very quickly shifting race for governor.
Well, they're counted, but they just can't be disqualified and recast.
I'm glad you corrected me there.
Actually, they will absolutely
count. They will actually be counted no matter who you voted them for. But changing your mind is not a reason to recast your ballot, according to Wisconsin Elections Commission guidance. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. This has been Inside Wisconsin Politics.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org.
Coming up in the early 1900s, pioneering social activist Lizzie Kander turned a recipe book she made for Milwaukee immigrants into the most successful charitable cookbook in American history. A scholar chronicles the impact of the Settlement Cookbook.
There was this kind of legend around it, particularly in Milwaukee, about the way that Lizzie Kander had produced this book.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. In 1926, Lake Ivanhoe was founded as a Black-owned resort community in southern Wisconsin. It became a safe haven for Black families from across the Midwest. This weekend, Lake Ivanhoe will celebrate its centennial.
WPR's Diane Bazooka visited the community in 2022 when a new historical marker was placed to commemorate its role in Wisconsin history. She brings us this story.
6 miles east of Lake Geneva is a small subdivision nestled beside a quiet lake, Lake Ivanhoe. Peter Baker first visited in the 1960s. He was 9 years old, and his friend brought him up from Chicago on a fishing trip.
I bet we caught over 70, 100 fish, bluegills and crappies, and it was the most exciting and life-changing thing for me. So we went home, and I ran in the house with all these fish, and I showed my mother. We were up there in Lake Ivanhoe, and it was all black. And the first thing she said is to my father, Ernest, we're going up there next week.
The Bakers bought a house on Tuskegee Drive and moved the family up from Chicago. During the era of sundown towns where African Americans were not welcome after dark, he says Lake Ivanhoe was a refuge.
This was about as safe as life could get up here. because we literally could sit in the middle of the roads at nighttime and watch the stars and talk and play. The freedom was unbelievable.
Baker later learned that was the whole idea when the community was dreamed up a century ago as the first Black-founded development in Wisconsin. In the wake of nationwide race riots, African American leaders from Chicago bought the land in the 1920s to build a Black resort town.
It was an immediate hit, drawing families from across the region and performances at a central pavilion by acts like Cab Calloway. But the stock market crash in 1929 brought it all to an end. Following World War II, families like the Bakers rediscovered Lake Ivanhoe and slowly made it a year-round community. Baker eventually built his own home and raised his family here. Now he's president of the Lake Ivanhoe Homeowners Association.
This is our clubhouse right here. It was a much smaller place.
But he says things have changed. Now the community is mostly white and Hispanic. African Americans are only about 10% of the population.
The lake needs dredging, the road needs repair, and the history of Lake Ivanhoe is fading.
That's why Baker has been working on getting a historical marker. In recent years, he's been getting help from Katie Green.
Have you ever seen this?
Are these guys fishing on Lake Ivanhoe?
Yes, ice fishing. Look at this here.
Green has spent summers in Lake Geneva since the 70s, but she had never heard of Lake Ivanhoe until a few years ago when a friend's grandmother mentioned it.
I had asked all my friends that I grew up with in Lake Geneva. I asked all my current neighbors, have you heard of Ivanhoe? Nope, nope, nobody that I knew. So I started to dig into it.
That's how she met Baker. Now she and Baker often spend their Saturdays combing through old documents and newspapers.
Carol and Billy Cross? Do you?
They're trying to connect with past residents. One of the people they found was Janet Alexander Davis, who came to Lake Ivanhoe in the 50s on family fishing trips.
One time I caught what they call a dogfish. That was the ugliest fish I've ever seen. Ugly and big. But I was so proud of that fish.
She hasn't been back since childhood, but she's excited about the marker.
It's proof that we were treated differently in this society and continue to be, that we had to find our own way and have our own things because we couldn't just go where we wanted to go, to shop, to live, or to buy. So what I felt there was free.
Baker's planning a dedication ceremony for the new marker.
He wants to invite past residents, have a pig roast and big band music, like the old days.
I plan on being here for a long time, hopefully for the rest of my life. And I just hope it's always a place that African Americans can feel safe in. I literally am at peace here.
And he believes recognizing the community is the best way to ensure future generations find refuge there, too.
Diane Bazooka brought us that story on Lake Ivanhoe, which is celebrating its 100-year history this weekend. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
This is WPR News.
In 1901, Milwaukee native Lizzie Kander was teaching kosher cooking classes to immigrants at the Milwaukee Jewish Mission. The women copied down the recipes, but to Kander, this felt like wasted time.
Kander envisioned compiling the recipes and household tips into a pamphlet to sell to the community and in the process raise money for Milwaukee's urban poor.
The Settlement Cookbook would go on to become the most successful charitable cookbook in American history with 40 editions and over 2 million copies sold.
It was an influential cookbook for immigrant women reflecting upper middle class lifestyles.
Like the recipe for grapefruit, which shows how much food presentation mattered.
Remove from the skin the cells and juice. Add a little sugar, chopped pineapple, and a few maraschino cherries. Serve very cold in thin glasses, surrounded with crushed ice or in fruit shells.
Our next guest has studied the book's evolution over nearly a century. Nora Rubel is a professor in the Department of Religion and Classics at University of Rochester. Her new book is called Recipes for the Melting Pot, The Lives of the Settlement Cookbook. She starts by recounting how she first learned of the cookbook.
I was in grad school. I was working on other projects, but I was very interested in religion and food and ethnicity and immigration. And when you read particularly Jewish memoirs or secondary sources about Jewish immigration, this cookbook kept coming up. I thought, this seems to be important, but then I couldn't find a lot written on it. There was a little bit, but really not a ton of scholarship on this thing that seemed to be important to a lot of people. And I'm Jewish, but since I don't have like American ancestry, I asked my other American Jewish friends and they were like, oh yeah, I grew up with that. Oh yeah, my grandmother had that cookbook. I love it. And I'm like, do you cook from it? They're like, no, but it's important that I have it. So I just started digging and I became fascinated by it.
You quote this magazine writer in 1965 who declares, there are two things no bride should be without. One, of course, is a bridegroom. The other, as every wise Milwaukee housewife knows, is a copy of the Settlement Cookbook. How did this cookbook take hold and become such a staple not only in Milwaukee kitchens, but across the country and even in other parts of the world?
Yeah, I mean, it went everywhere. And part of it had to do with its emphasis on the test kitchen. A lot of people felt that this was a cookbook that no matter what you did, if you followed the recipe, you would end up with something good. And there was this kind of legend around it, particularly in Milwaukee, about the way that Lizzie Kander, the editor and the head of the Settlement House where it came out of, the way that she had produced this book in consultation with both her students and with her friends and social acquaintances.
Can you talk more about Lizzie's Settlement House? What happened in these houses?
So Lizzie Kander ran a settlement house in Milwaukee. The settlement houses were a means of welcoming and helping the new immigrants in our cities to acculturate, to learn English, to learn American manners and mores, essentially keep the kids off the streets and turn the immigrants into good American citizens. Lizzie's house was geared towards Jewish immigrants, and she had a kosher cooking class, which was important because a lot of other settlements didn't have any kind of kosher facilities.
And she had the only professional kosher kitchen, you say, outside of New York.
Correct. Yes. So wow. It was a big deal that she was willing, despite the fact that she was a Reformed Jew and did not keep kosher at all, that she wanted to meet these students where they were and teach them how to cook with American ingredients and how to keep house here. But, you know, she wanted them to feel comfortable. So this was actually kind of unique in the settlement movement. And this cookbook came out of these classes. At the time, community cookbooks were really popular with women's groups. I'm sure your listeners have probably these spiral-bound church volumes or, you know, community neighborhood fundraising cookbooks. So this was something that she thought, oh, I can do this. And the legend is that she became tired of the students having to write down all of the recipes and that she thought, okay, well, this is taking up too much time. Why don't we make a pamphlet that we can sell that will have the recipes in it and we can sell it to the students for very little and then also raise money. And she went to the board of the Milwaukee Jewish Mission, which is what it was called at the time, and asked for $18 to print it. And they said, no, that sounds very extravagant. But we would also be very happy to, shall you go ahead with this, share in your profits. So she creates this pamphlet. Half of it is the recipes from the cooking classes, and half of it is sort of recipes that she and her friends like. And then she sells it for 50 cents at the Boston store. It gets picked up in Chicago. People become crazy for it. Sells out of its first 500. They have to do another printing. And then in 1903, they did a real cookbook. 9 years later, she bought those men at the Milwaukee Mission a new building.
Wow.
With the profits.
Wow.
So it's a really kind of amazing story. And it went through 40 editions.
Hmm. A couple words in your book's title, Melting Pot, they can be controversial. Did Lizzie Kander want European immigrants to abandon their customs and values to fit into life in America?
I think that at the time, you know, this is kind of the backdrop is domestic science. So I think she wanted them to be able to be part of the current American culture. But she also was really what I called a culinary pluralist. So she saw that there was an opportunity to demonstrate both that America is multi-ethnic, multi-religious, made up of people from all kinds of places. And when she creates this cookbook, it's incredibly broad. It has tons of recipes from all over, including Jewish recipes. And it's a way of expressing that Jews have a place in this, you know, grand tapestry of America. And she said this was made up of recipes from all nationalities because that is what America is.
Hmm. Lizzie Kander served as the Settlement Cookbook's visionary leader for 40 years. And then on July 24th, 1940, you write about the headline in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that reads, "Civic Leader is Dead." What happened to the community and the movement that Kander built after she died?
Well, they rallied after really mourning this loss because it was a collective of women that worked on this project for so long. She was the sole person who was there from the beginning to her death. You know, they said she was testing recipes the day she died. You know, that this was just something that was a labor of love. It was really important to her. And they were determined to keep it going. So they had created the Settlement Cookbook Company. They had a charter. They were giving a lot of money to the Milwaukee community. And they continued on. Eventually, Sarah Ettenheim, who was the daughter-in-law of someone on the original board, took over in Kander's place and really pushed it to become sort of the global phenomenon it was, even though it had already been internationally received. Ettenheim ultimately secured a distribution deal and then a publishing deal with Simon & Schuster.
And the final Simon & Schuster edition, that comes out in 1991, I believe. What were these cookbooks like at the end of their run?
Well, I mean, they changed a lot over time. And in Kander's lifetime, they just continued to expand. They got bigger and bigger. Once Simon & Schuster was involved, they were like, you know, you can't just keep printing cookbooks. You have to have like 35% of it has to be different, you know, or be changed in some way. So they slowed down and they changed a little bit. So in 1965, the book is radically revised. It's this really cool looking cover, very retro and mod. And it's very chatty in a way that the original ones were not. It was a very encyclopedic, no-nonsense cookbook. And Julia Child and The Joy of Cooking really changed the way cookbooks were written. I think that the subsequent copies of the Settlement Cookbook changed accordingly. And by the way, that is why this is such a fascinating project, because you go from 1901 to 1991, you really can look at almost a century of American history through these cookbooks. The last one is pretty different from the rest of them, and it's the one that was not actually done through the Settlement Cookbook Board. Everyone had pretty much retired a few years prior, and Simon & Schuster consulted with them and worked with them when they put together this cookbook, but it was really sort of a reboot.
Nora, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Nora Rubel is a professor in the Department of Religion and Classics at University of Rochester. Her new book is Recipes for the Melting Pot, The Lives of the Settlement Cookbook. We asked for your community cookbook stories, and we heard from Sherry, who was a 4-H member and relied on her mom's church cookbooks for Kewaunee County Fair food project entries.
Sherry writes the cookbooks were well-loved and well-stained from so much used by me and my 6 brothers and sisters over the years.
Sherry goes on to say, my mom loved these cookbooks so much that we decided to publish mom's own cookbook of favorite family recipes when she was in her 80s. This endeavor was so fun and meaningful.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Sherry. You can share your story about special cookbook projects and what they have meant to you. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text. That number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is acting executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.